So I'm Dr. Eric London. I'm at the New York State Institute for Basic Research. And I'm going to be talking about the diagnosis. It's going to be a little bit more clinical than other people's talks. So the beginning of wisdom is to call things by their proper names, maybe a little more philosophical too. And this is actually the talk in a nutshell. Probably all seen this slide or something like it. Fairly well known, but I'm not sure we've really dealt with it. So to understand diagnosis and where we're at, let's review a little bit of history. The DSM-3 in 1980 was a revolutionary step. It was the first systematization of psychiatric diagnosis. And it was a huge leap forward, mostly in the realm of reliability. So we could talk to each other, we could standardize diagnosis. But there was no pretense, and there's never been any pretense that it represented etiology. The DSM used what some have described as the wise professor model, the wise professor being Kraepelin or Kanner, who described his patients, and classified them with names. We don't have wise professors now, we have committees. But we still have categories, and I think categories is a very important word throughout this talk. We use categorical diagnosis. Categorical diagnosis works best for infectious diseases. So an example might be strep throat. We know what the agent is. We know where it hits. We know how to treat it. We know when you have it. We know when you don't have it. And there's really nice boundaries. It works less well for chronic systemic illnesses such as diabetes. Less well probably for psychiatric disorders, probably due to the complexity of the brain. And maybe even less well for developmental disorders, which are even more complicated due to the ongoing development and change. So I'm going to say somewhat poetically, the question I'd like to pose is autism a natural kind, that is, does it exist in nature, or is it a free-floating set of symptoms in a sea of symptoms? And this remains a fundamental unanswered question. I believe that all the iterations of the DSM, including the 5, continue to circle around Kanner's description with the hope that if we can find the proper cutoff points, we will identify autism as a natural kind. And I personally have come to believe that that's not true. And we've had 60 years of lack of success at this. And in fact, this is true of all psychiatry. So the DSM is going through the same growing pains with all diseases. I'd like to go over the word diagnosis. It's a very widely used word, and we all use diagnosis, but I was surprised when I really looked it up and what it meant. It's a name given to a clinical observation in order to create a shorthand way of describing a complicated entity, which is present in nature. It is designed not to look harder or more closely, but the opposite. It's designed to reduce awareness by censoring out large ranges of features and so it could be practical. So a diagnosis is like a name. So we call somebody Fred, and that helps us. Oh, it's Fred. That doesn't really describe Fred. Well, many people could describe Fred in many different ways. Diagnosis should be useful to the physician, and after all, diagnosis is a term that comes out of the medical model. To communicate the nature of the problem, to plan the workup and treatment, and make inferences about prognosis, the things doctors are supposed to do when they see you in their office. And diagnosis is a tool. It's something we use. So it's not God-given. It's something we've created to help us. And what is diagnosis not? Well, diagnosis is not phenotype. So people doing research should be characterizing their populations and their people. And I don't believe they should be using diagnosis for that. Diagnosis is not a functional descriptor. We have the ICF for that. We can describe people's functioning ability. And diagnosis is not assessment parameters. Our patients have so many problems, and maybe we don't assess them well enough because we can characterize them pretty easily with a diagnosis. So it might be actually retarding our ability to do good assessment. So diagnosis was never meant to be an all-encompassing way of describing a clinical situation. And I want to define one more word. which is very important in this discussion, reification. And reification means to make something real, to attribute concreteness to something which is actually ambiguous. So when the DSM was started, the framers knew that the diagnoses they were choosing were not real. And they used the term waystation or placeholder. And they said that that would be used until diagnosis with more biological reality can be discerned. And I'm afraid that we've forgotten that. So now let's talk specifically about autism. So what is the meaning of autism? Well, this was addressed by Michael Rutter in 1978, and I think it's a really cool quote. What's the true definition of autism? The question in itself is a mistake. There is no point in starting with a word and then defining it. It means whatever we want it to mean. It can be used to describe Kanner's cases or merely to describe those with poor eye contact. And in fact, that's actually what's happened over the years. We've broadened the definition, we've constricted the definition. Whatever we want it to mean is what it means. Lovaas, another giant in the field of autism, had this quote, even earlier, 1971. Like any hypothesis, autism as a construct may facilitate research, or it may prematurely freeze or misdirect inquiry into helping children to whom the term is applied. So it sounds like both Rutter and Lovaas knew well that autism was just a provisional way station. So here's just a little visual aid about what we've done with diagnosis. So I have social and I have repetitive behaviors, and I put motor in because motor is so common in our population. But we could put any number of axes and any number of symptoms. And people have different combinations of symptoms. This is nothing specific. This is just general. So what did we do? Well, what did we do? Oh, there it is. Well, we've lopped off a certain number of symptoms, and we call it autism. And then what we did is we got really even better at making it standardized. So we have a gold standard. Well, but the question is, in the gold standard, what are we going to do with the people who aren't inside the gold standard? What about, what about the people up there or the people down there? What do we call them? As a matter of fact, in reality, sometimes we don't call them anything, and I have to tell that to parents very often. But psychiatry has dealt with this over the years, and this is what happens. We make up new categories. And as a matter of fact, DSM-5 did that with social communicative disorder. But the number of categories has proliferated since the DSM-3 because we're cutting off nature, not necessarily at nature's joints, as someone has nicely put it. So the problem is we're always left with overflow. So that overflow sometimes is called comorbidities. The ADAM program, the CDC, found that 60% of those with autism had one co-occurring diagnosis. Another 26% had two or more, for a total of 86%. So only 14% of autistic people have autism with no other diagnosis. That's a lot. Out of the 16 types of medical symptoms in one study, only three, blood diseases, neoplasms, and GU, were not significantly associated with autism. So when we're talking about autism, we're talking about something very heterogeneous with other diagnosable issues, not only other symptoms, but other diagnosable issues. This is a paper about motor functioning, and in this paper, they found 95% of normal IQ autistics had motor deficits, which are listed here. If you look at the bottom of the slide, though, there's 53% in other psychiatric disorders and 6% in neurotypicals. So what does that mean? Motor problems are very, very common. They're common in all of psychiatry, even though as psychiatrists we've been pretty adept at ignoring them. And it's not present in the neurotypicals. So the question is, should motor symptoms be a part of the diagnosis? Well, I would make the case that because they're so common, and they're actually seem central to the pathophysiology of autism. So I put up two studies here, both on baby SIBs, and both found that motor symptoms were found very early. Both predicted very strongly communicative and social deficits later. And this paper by Sutera in 2007, looking at two-year-olds, found that the number one predictor of who was going to do well versus who wasn't is people with motor deficits were not going to do well. Symptom severity, socialization, and communication between children had no prognostic value. So not only is motor extremely common, but it's probably the most predictive sign we have in very young children. So now I'm going to put up 13 points about why the categorical diagnosis of autism is a problem. Number one, there is a lack of zones of rarity, and this is something that's been described as necessary for a good categorical diagnosis. So the symptoms that I mention up there, motor, social, language, drift seamlessly into other disorders, and they drift seamlessly into normality. So this paper by Dyke very nicely describes the predicament that all the developmental disorders have with lack of rarity, zones of rarity. Number two, traits are found in a smooth continuum, and there's good literature on that. The excluded symptoms from the diagnosis, such as motor, seizures, anxiety, are no less important than the core symptoms. And so when you're treating a patient, you may be taking their most important problems and just saying, well, that's really not important for your diagnosis, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense at that time. Autism has wide phenotypic heterogeneity and almost endless comorbidities, as we've talked about. So here's another visual aid about our predicament. So the cloud is all the developmental problems that brains might have, and we take a little group of it, make a circle around it, we'll call it autism. But then what happens? You have intellectual deficit, which cuts through autism, but it cuts outside of autism. And then what happens? You have motor deficits, which does the same. You have self-injurious behaviors, which could do the same. You have epilepsy, which could do the same. I can go on and on with this. Now, look at the cloud again. You know, how much sense does that circle around autism make at this point when you've included these other symptoms? Back to the 13 points. Phenotypic descriptors are not valid. I'll give you a very powerful example is in the restrictive and repetitive behaviors fall into at least two clusters. At least one paper had five different clusters of what they are. And these might be high-order motor actions or very low-order motor actions, probably coming from different parts of the brain, probably having different etiologies, and yet we're calling them one symptom. Social deficits are very heterogeneous, and they're hard to define. Are we talking about social anxiety? Are we talking about lack of social interest? Are we talking about social cognition problems? It's not really that well defined. And I believe that our reification of the diagnosis, knowing how to make the diagnosis, has kind of relieved us from the burden of actually defining what these problems are. Number six, evidence exists that the etiologic independence of, that there's etiologic independence of the core symptoms. Now, I think the DSM-5 has improved the situation, but it's still an ongoing problem. Number seven, the diagnosis of autism is a poor predictor of outcome, and there's a lot of literature on that. This Fountain paper that I referenced lists six different outcome courses in six different groups. Other papers divide it differently. But nevertheless, we can't predict outcome at this point, so the diagnosis doesn't help us with that. Number eight, the diagnosis is too difficult to make, leading to alienation of primary care, and I'm going to talk a lot about that, so I'll move on. Diagnosis is minimally informative for treatment targets, as I was talking about, the comorbidities are equally valid treatment targets, and I'll talk about that. The reification of the diagnosis dictates program formulation. So we make a diagnosis, and then we go to administrators and government officials, and we say we need programs for autism. So they say, okay, whatever you guys say, you're the experts. So we create programs for autism, but are we doing that at the expense of individualized care? Are we not necessarily giving people what they need, but we're lumping them together in programs due to their diagnosis? So the National Research Council on Education, the top paragraph, made a recommendations for what a good evaluation is. And Huerta and Lord in 2012 wrote in a paper that this type of evaluation is typically beyond the scope of usual pediatric practice, so most cases depend on appropriate referral, which on the surface sounds fine, but it's I think it's actually extremely problematic. So let's take a look. Now I'm going to get real clinical. So let's take a look at the diagnostic process. Based on the literature, the diagnostic process takes between 1 and 4 years, and that's from the time the parent becomes concerned to the time a diagnosis is given. The average age of diagnosis is over the age of 6, and we heard in this morning's talk, 9 and 10 in the UK. So the delay sets back the introduction of treatment that could be critical. I think probably most of the people in this room would believe in early intervention, and yet we're waiting to an advanced age before we're actually giving diagnosis, which very often sets the machinery in motion to get the early interventions that we need. The next paragraph, what mattered most to parents was the physician being sensitive to their needs as parents and a family. Part of the perceived sensitivity comes from the communication that the physician will continue to be with you. It's the primary care model. It's your family doctor. It's the one who's been with you all your life. Obviously, in Western countries, this is a dying breed, and medicine is doing whatever they can to revive it. But certainly, by taking the cases away from the primary care physician, we're not going in the right direction. In families of developmentally disabled children, one of the 5 most important factors for the success was the initial experience that that family had. And this period, the initial diagnostic period, has been shown to have lasting effect on the parent's ability to cope with the child's condition. Parents of what everyone knows, this has been reported over and over again, but parents of autistic children have extremely high stress levels and poor family functioning. High parental stress can counteract even teaching interventions. 30 to 40% of parents in this study reported that they received no offer of help at the time of diagnosis. So our diagnostic process is not doing well. And I believe that families contrast their confused PCP, who is inadequate to make the diagnosis, with the confident treatment professionals that they find on the internet, who very often have untested treatments, including promoting issues such as vaccination refusal. So just imagine yourself in a parent's condition. You have this devastating illness. You keep going to people. They keep saying they can't handle it. If you finally get a referral, you might go to the tertiary care center, which in America very often means a 6 to 9 month waiting list to get this diagnosis. And then you go on the internet and hear someone saying, look, I understand autism. I'm a really good clinician. And by the way, my patients all get better. How could you not go to those type of practitioners? And then, you know, people kind of scratch their heads, like, why are they doing it? So the problem with diagnosis by primary care providers, parents rate PCPs as inadequate, and there's quite a bit of literature about that too. And the PCPs actually rate themselves as inadequate. And that was in a study by Golnick in 2009. Now, they contrasted their inadequacy with treating various other illnesses like hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy. To me, treating autism shouldn't be any harder than that. Research shows satisfactory medical homes are not available for autism. The behaviorists actually had it right, I think, very early on. This is from a paper by Lovas and Smith. And they basically say, let's break down the larger problem into small units, and those are behaviors. And even if it's not part of the diagnosis, well, basically, like, who cares? That helps us to avoid the heterogeneity and the comorbidity problems anyhow. So why not just treat what we're here to treat? The behaviorist uses accumulated facts piece by piece. And this may be much more scientific, especially with a disorder that has no external validation. The last 3 points I want to make are for research. Reification dictates the research agenda. And I'm a little short on time, so I'm going to go by them quickly. But Steve Hyman basically pointed out that mucho dollars were spent by the NIMH on genetic studies using diagnosis as if it was going to fit in. There's substantial doubt that autism is a natural kind, and it's a very dubious entity to be studied biologically. And Akil et al. Basically are saying what the R-docs are referring to and what Dr. Sweeney was talking about, that what we really need to be treating is circuitry and problems that people actually have. And the last one is the categorical diagnosis mediates against quantitative methodologies. So this is from a paper by Plowman in 2009. Disorders are more being conceptualized as extremes of quantitative traits, and the heritability of these traits are due to multiple genes of small effect, although Susan's throwing some cold water on that. The disorders are contrasted with normality. However, if the traits are in a continuum, non-cases may be almost as bad as cases. And so we tend to do case controls with categorical diagnoses, whereas with treating dimensions, we tend to need to use population-based studies, which may be more realistic. And then Plowman went on to say, if we want to think quantitatively, it would be aided by speaking quantitatively. We need a shift in vocabulary talking about dimensions, not disorders. So I'm going to conclude with some solutions. So Einstein said, if you can't explain it simply, you don't understand it well enough. Maybe he didn't agree with himself. Anyhow, one solution would be the ICD-11, and that's the competitor to the DSM. It's for all of medicine, put out by the World Health Organization, and their primary interest is public health. And so they've come to the conclusion that the very Byzantine way of making these diagnoses is completely inadequate for public health purposes. So they're actually going to create two versions, a primary care version and a specialist version, and that might be a solution. Michael Rutter in 2011, working on the primary care version, basically listed some requirements, and it's basically keep it simple, stupid. There's a solution I would like to propose, which I think is not ready for prime time, so I'm not really saying here it is, but I would like, if people can walk away from this talk thinking about it, then I've achieved my goal. Andrews et al. In 2009 held a committee on behalf of the APA Diagnostic Spectra Group suggesting metastructures. And so what that means for us would be taking all 22 neurodevelopmental disorders in that group of the DSM, and we'll call that a diagnosis. So the diagnosis would be neurodevelopmental disorder with X features. So we'll have a disorder, and then we'll have features. This is not terribly novel. This is what's done in the ICD for medical disorders. You have diabetes, which can be easily defined by lab tests, with disorders of vision, renal function, etc. So this is what it might look like. I picked out six features of. I don't know how many we would want to have. I don't know if it would be one big standardized box or what people would do right in. But we could have mild, significant, severe, and this would be doable even for PCPs. Not everyone can, for example, evaluate postural disorder. Maybe you need a specialist to do that. But to come back, you would have a neurodevelopmental disorder with these particular problems, and it would really make sense, especially for primary care, to help with understanding how to make referrals, what needs to be treated, maybe program design. And these would be the advantages. A more accurate reflection of natural kind. So we all believe this is a neurodevelopmental disorder, and we're seeing the symptoms, so we're not making any inferences. It will encourage more focused and accurate research questions, which may hasten progress. A lot of the problems which we might have had, the reason why maybe some of the genetics hasn't come out is because we have this big, broad diagnostic category of many, many diseases of many, many causes, and we're trying to find a gene that's going to do it. By being more select, we may really hasten the progress of our research. And also, I guess to be fair, researchers have been lazy. The gold standard has helped us be lazy. So we don't have to, geneticists don't have to worry about the phenotype. They can just go ahead and plug in the gold standard. It will discourage reification. Nobody is going to mistake neurodevelopmental disorder with X features for a real God-given disease. So we know, we'll know it's a description, not a category. It will encourage more in-depth assessment, which I mentioned before. It will encourage individualizing clinical interventions and program, and it will demystify autism for the public and encourage primary care participation. So, thank you. And now we're going to have about 15 minutes for discussion, and so all the panelists should come on up here, and Ira Cohn from the Institute for Basic Research will lead the discussion. And questions.
I hope that didn't hurt anybody besides me. All right, so I want to thank Eric for putting this symposium together, and it really, I think, deals with some extremely important issues. Just a little bit about my background. I started working in the field of autism in 1978, pre-DSM-3, when autism was considered to be a childhood psychosis. In fact, prior to that, I was, when I would teach classes, at university, and I would teach about autism, I would always show a film that was put together by Ivar Lovaas, and it was called Teaching Language to Psychotic Children. And I became intrigued with that, and then somehow found myself later doing research on autism. But there was this belief that this is a disorder that was largely a psychosis. And at the time, of course, what was the cause? Well, the mothers did it. And so we knew what it was, we knew what the background was, and then we knew what the cause was, and clearly the treatment was years of psychoanalysis, both for the child and the mom. Fathers were never suspected of causing problems. And unfortunately, some places in the world, that's still an issue, believe it or not. And it's something that I had to deal with, I guess, about 10 years ago. And so we've come a long way, and we've seen as Erica has mentioned, the movement from a disorder which was very poorly defined prior to the DSM-3 to an attempt to define it in some sort of categorical way, and then moving from essentially three kinds of autism to two kinds of autism to five kinds of autism, now one kind of autism. And so we're kind of shooting around, as Eric mentioned, and trying to identify what we're doing. And we've managed to succeed. We are here at this meeting. I mean, this meeting started, there were a total of 400 or 500 attendees at the first meeting, and now we're about 2,000. Clearly people are seeing something. They're seeing kids with autism, and we can recognize it when we see it. I thought I knew what autism was until I took training in how to do diagnosis of autism. And then I saw cases that I would say, by definition, had to be autistic according to the checklist I was filling out. But when I saw them clinically, I didn't think they had it. So we're kind of in this quandary what to do. And yet we have these diagnoses that we have to make. We have to make it for a number of reasons. For one thing, at least in the city of New York, if a child is to get intensive intervention, which we know is very helpful, they have to have a diagnosis, which means they have to see an experienced professional. Sometimes they can get it from their primary care physicians, and more often they get referred to tertiary centers like the Institute. And so we have to have that. Also, if you're trying to get funds from the government, you have to have a diagnosis. If you're an epidemiologist, you have to have something to count. And so you have to have this label. But as we've seen, there are problems and there's issues. And prior to my working in the clinical field, when I was doing my graduate work, I was working in a rat lab. And I was trained as an operant conditioner. And so I'm very familiar with getting a proper behavior measures. And when I first started working in the field of autism, we were doing work at Bellevue Hospital, treating these so-called psychotic children with medications, and I brought in some of the techniques I had learned in the animal laboratory into that environment, and I think we were able to use it, such things as using repeated measures designs. so that if there were subject variability, you could see it over time and figure out what was normal variability for that individual and what was due to treatment. As a result of that, in one of the first studies that was being done at the hospital was looking at treatment of these kids with thyroid hormone. There were a total of 30 cases in that study. And of course, in those 30 cases, the overall means showed no effect. But because the study involved repeated measures and a crossover design, it was possible to identify individual responders. Lo and behold, 4 kids responded. And we could not have seen it if we just looked at means. We also brought in an operant conditioning apparatus. I had kids pressing levers on multiple schedules of reinforcement, and we found somewhat similar results to what was reporting here, a tendency for kids to respond in the presence of non-reward after being rewarded in another situation. So another way of getting around this is that I have a sympathy for the way that things are going. And so on the one hand, from a research perspective, I'm encouraged by what's going on and the attempt to take a dimensional view. But on the other hand, as a clinician, I know that we have to make this diagnosis and we have to get these services. And we have to frequently make what are called differential diagnoses. Does this child have autism, or does he have ADHD, or does he have a social anxiety disorder? These are important issues that we have to go over. So my questions, I guess, to the panelists are, and then we'll open it up to the audience, to what extent are what we're seeing in these individuals, things like autism and ADD and so forth, real, as Eric has alluded to, natural kinds, or are they constellations? Are we imposing order on a random series of events and making it real when it's not? And if they are real, what do you think would be the explanation for why we're seeing these differential effects over time in the course of development? Are we seeing things, are these things that are largely genetic, are they related to environmental factors, or are they sort of stochastic events that would take place with very complicated brain circuitry? So anybody care to answer the question as to whether in fact what we're seeing are real or not? I know Eric's point of view.
I think this is a really important question. I don't think I can say I know the answer, but I think I'll go back to my fever analogy before. I think with Kathy Lord and others, we've done a good job over the last 20 years of drawing a circle around something that with some fuzzy boundaries and with overlap with lots of other things, can identify a group of people that have this broad general syndrome. But I really think that the move forward is going to be, knowing that someone has fever is not really what a doctor needs to know. A doctor needs to know what's causing the fever, and that means getting at mechanisms, and that means identifying different pathways to get there. And I think that's really what we need to instantiate. I think that's the big question where the field needs to move forward. For now, we diagnose people, they can get treatment. We don't have another much option in the practical world, but In the future, the pathway, I think, is going to define the pathways, the etiologic pathways that people get that way, that we can separate the people out that have different pathways of risk and then identify the right treatments for those people with their own individualized problems.
I guess I would also agree with that. But I think an interesting question is, If we think about circuitry, for instance, as sort of the place to start, we know that circuits interact, we know they talk to each other. It's very complicated, but things do tend to cluster together. And so whether they're not neatly divided into categories, obviously, but I think one of the interesting questions is why do certain things hang together so that you do know an autistic person when you meet them, or you do recognize psychosis when you see it, even though it has shared dimensions with other disorders.
Okay.
I think I would just add to that I've never really been a big fan of the DSM and have never really found it to be useful in at least genetic research. And in fact, there's historical precedent. A geneticist from the UK many years ago, Tim Crow, advocated for putting all psychiatric disorders on a continuum of severity and really considering them all as psychiatric disorders that we should be studying genetically without diagnostic boundaries between them. I'm not sure that it's that much more useful to try to determine what severity is across all of those entities, but I think it's probably moving in a better direction to do that than to be carving up things so artificially in the way that we do it today.
I'd like to add one more thing. I would like to compliment Eric on what I thought was a really wonderful suggestion. I think following that kind of approach to diagnosis would really help identify the problems that a clinician needs to treat a lot better than giving someone a diagnosis of autism.
Thank you. Question from the audience. Is there a microphone?
One of the advantages to the monolithic approach, one of the few advantages, is that it does give a general sense of where somebody has been, where they potentially are going, over, especially developmental disorder. I'm curious, I really like the new systems. Is there a way that you guys are thinking in terms of capturing maybe where somebody was as they get some of those check boxes, but then as they move along, you know, you're going to lose some of those, gain some of those, and we're still going to try to keep it together.
I'm a clinical research fellow, and I do electrophysiology, so I really like this new system for biomarkers and things like that, but I do wonder if we may lose some things or lose, like, shift them to the world. I'm not sure if you were talking about Eric's system or the RDoC system. Yeah, I think that's really, it's incredibly important how things develop over time, in both in terms of where things diverge from a typical pattern, and when they diverge from a typical pattern, and also in tracing individuals. RDoC hasn't figured out yet how to incorporate that into the schema that's up now, but is looking for input and suggestions. So it's, I think it's very, very important.
You know, it's not clear that our medical colleagues have figured things out either, but they have a much easier life. As I was talking about strep throat, the infectious disease guys had it really easy. I mean, conceptually, it makes perfect sense. The rest of medicine is struggling with things like this. How do you talk about diabetes? How do you talk about chronic illness? It's getting to the point where they also are questioning their descriptions. I think with brain study, we're at a level now which we've never been at before in the history of humanity, where we know enough about the brain to actually start asking some more sophisticated questions. And that's going to require different ways of looking at it. The categorical diagnosis is really 18th century stuff. And, you know, we've updated it a little bit, but it's really, I'm sorry, not 19th century stuff.
A little slight devil's advocate kind of position, which maybe Eric would care to address. I mean, this kind of issue that you discussed was sort of addressed by Christopher Gilbert last year at the keynote address when he talked about his essence concept, which is all the kids have overlapping behavior problems. Let's just get an assessment done and get them services. But if I'm a parent of a child who's behaving in my perception differently from his siblings or from the other kids in the neighborhood, and I hear this word autism around, I want to know if my kid has that, what do you tell them? Because in some ways, giving a name to something is comforting. You know you're not alone. So how would you deal with a situation like that?
Well, I think one of the problems with thinking about this is that we're so immersed in our current nosology that it's like taking the ground out from under us. I mean, we're at the International Meeting for Autism Research.
Right.
If we stop using the word autism, what are we going to call this next year? It would be educating the public also. Instead of having to give a categorical diagnosis, We're going to be telling the parent, well, you have a neurodevelopmental problem, and these are the problems. And this is our latest knowledge of the brain is that these particular dimensions are problematic, but we have a guy over here who treats this and a guy who treats that. And I think if one of the slides I put up with is that the parents want to be understood. And they want to know that the treatment people are going to recognize their predicament and deal with it. And I think the language that we use is not, the parents aren't going to object to the language. They object to the fact that if they go home, they have no hope and there's nothing to do.
Any questions?
In our center, we see adults who identify themselves very clearly as having autism, and they sometimes debate the idea of saying, I have autism, or I am autistic, or something like that. And I am concerned, having come from the era when we talked about a lot of neurodevelopmental disorders, that there's a very different perception when one talks about a disorder than to say, well, I have diabetes, or I have something else that is not with the word disorder in it, per se. So I think that it's quite a challenge. While I like the concept that there are characteristics that might prove to be challenging for one person or another, to use the term a neurodevelopmental disorder is not something that I see our adults on the spectrum being fans of using. And I think it's helpful for people to be able to say to someone, well, I have autism, or I have, or I'm on the autism spectrum, and that helps other people to begin to take a look at understanding why the behaviors may be somewhat different, or some of the characteristics are associated with that.
I would agree with that. I just want to, I think there is a point at which having a label or a name for something is helpful, because it encapsulates, for the therapist at least, what to expect to a certain extent, or what to look for, even if one is doing an ABC analysis as part of a treatment study. And I'll give you a quick case, and then I think we have time for one other question. Someone had discussed with me a case of a woman who was residing in a group home. She had a severe intellectual disability and was never a major behavior problem until Christmas, when they would bring in the tree. And the woman would severely go after the tree, attack it, rip the leaves off, and throw it out the window. And no one could figure out why this was taking place. And we had I had this discussion with this fellow, and I said, so what's her diagnosis? He says, well, intellectual disability. I said, well, have you looked in the records and see what it is? And it turned out she had been diagnosed as having autism when she was about 3. And I said, well, okay, well, you've brought the tree in, you've brought in other things. It's probably not the smell, it's probably not the color. What's different? So he went back and he looked, and it turned out they put the tree in its place where she would normally come and sit in the evening. So the treatment for her aggression was simply to put the tree in a different place, and all of the destruction stopped. So here's a case where having a clue as to what was going on was in some sense helpful. I see things, I see a good point and a bad point. As Yogi Berra said, in theory there's no difference between theory and practice. In practice there is.
Thank you very much. I'm very interested in genetics for autism. And I think the autism is very complex phenotype. So we need the new methodology for analyze it. So current, like a GWAS or current methodology might be limited. So do you have any comments on that?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the last part of that question again? I was distracted, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I feel that any new methodology in genetics for dealing with the, because the autism is a very complex phenotype, so current approach is enough, or new, so I'd like to know the new paradigms or methodologies.
Yeah, I agree. I think that we need to be able to do a better job incorporating environmental risk factors into our genetic models. I think we need to be able to do a better job at looking at epigenetic changes and that I think that the developmental trajectory is going to be important there as well, and we currently don't have ways of doing that so well. I agree.
Okay. Yeah. We've just been told we have to leave the room. Thank you.